Well, my first book was about my peninsula, the Leelanau Peninsula, which is about, 4 hours, 4.5 hours north of here, depending on how you drive. And I was writing then for Detroit Monthly Magazine. And so a lot of that book was first columns published by Detroit Monthly. Then I received several awards and did a next book about my state, Michigan, a lot of islands, because I was always curious about the offshore islands. And I think we've got about 30 of them, a lot of islands out there. But they were always difficult to get to and rather expensive. So when I had a chance to go to them, I went to a few of them. Then, with my children being grown and being very curious about the rest of the world, I accepted a fellowship from the William James Foundation and worked in the prisons of California. I wanted to understand why we had so many people in prison and what was happening there. And my curiosity led me from there to El Salvador, a couple tours in the Peace Corps, and traveling in between, and coming back again and again to the Leelanau Peninsula. I just wanted to understand the larger world. And at the same time that I was curious about basic human nature everywhere, the internet started. The first internet cafe in Guatemala, for instance, when I was there in 2001, was in someone's home. That was, and it was very primitive. Wikipedia didn't come online until about the same time, but it was very sparse. You couldn't get a lot of information. And of course, now we know that Wikipedia is rich with information, and it's instantaneous, and the internet is basically everywhere. That was almost 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And so I think that simultaneous with the internet, I felt a need to understand a larger world. And where this comes from with writers, I don't know. Writers will start pursuing something that really, it feels like they're evoking it, but they're just feeling it sooner. It's sort of coming up through the earth, through the soles of their feet, and they have this curiosity. So now I am 71, and I'm home for good. But that,
are you? Really? Are you finished?
I think so. The long arc of the universe, it was wonderful to drive in my car today for 4 hours.
Thank you for doing so. I love that you're here in person.
So I wanted to understand, and I think I did, but I wanted to understand, you know, bone deep level. I didn't want to understand from books, although I did a lot of reading as well. So that's what this book is about. And it's all of these travels. It's kind of like Odysseus, who wanted to leave his little island, and he had all of these adventures, and then he finally came home. So I think that maybe it's unusual for a woman to have done that.
I think so. I think so, Kathleen, because the traveling that I've done, one of the things that really caught my attention, there's not a lot of women traveling out there alone, and you haven't gone to safe places.
No, I went to third world countries, partly because that's where I could get work. I had a lot of experience as a teacher. That's what got me into the prisons. That is what got me into El Salvador. That's what allowed me to do two tours in the Peace Corps, is that it paid my way. I was not a rich woman traveling. I was earning my way.
Which probably gives you a deeper understanding, I think. You're almost forced to immerse yourself in the culture and get past the shiny Hiltons and all of that and get down there with the people who actually live there.
And I wanted to do that. And in fact, living on the Leelanau Peninsula in between, you know, getting grants to write, I worked as a waitress. I worked cleaning houses. I worked in a furniture store. I worked at Van's Garage. I went everywhere and did anything. And it gave me a much better sense of my community.
Mm.
So I think when I traveled to all of these places around the world, I interfaced with, you know, real people.
Right.
And that's what I wanted to do.
So when you say you wanted to get this core down to the bone understanding, did you achieve that?
I think so.
What did you learn? What were those lessons?
Well, first of all, you kind of know this before you go, but you're not sure. People are basically the same everywhere. Once you get past, differences in food, differences in etiquette, we're the same. Human beings are the same. You know, we care about our families. We cry when someone dies. We smile. We touch. We exchange information about how we're living. But I think that you don't know that until you see it and feel it.
Yeah, firsthand. In one way, when I read your book, the most intriguing part to me was your time working in the maximum security prison in California. Because that, even though it's in our own country, mm-hmm. it is a different culture.
It's a different world.
It is a different world. How did you feel? You're in there in this locked classroom with people who have committed all kinds of felonies, murders, and all of that. What did you learn there when you say people are the same?
And again, I learned that we're all just human beings. We can't be other than human beings. And it's interesting. Somebody could, you know, commit a murder, or some of them were hitmen. You know, they committed many. But there are whole parts of them where they love their families, where they like to sit on the beach, where they remember a special Christmas or another kind of holiday. They're just people. They're just people. And when you teach writing, which is what I did, you have to go to the healthy parts of the person and evoke their strength and evoke their spirit. That's how you teach writing. That's where their ability to express themselves comes from. So you have to be completely accepting. You acknowledge that they have had difficulties, but you don't dwell on that. I thought they would want to write about their experience in prison, since that's what I was interested in learning about. But no, they did not. They wanted to write about often things in nature. Or some
the
of them,
world out there.
The world out there. Or some of them, for instance, made the analogy. I had a lot of black and brown students, mostly black and brown students. They wanted to write about the similarities between slavery and their lives in the prisons. They saw a connection, and they felt that, and I think they were right, that our government has not done much to work with people to rehabilitate them. We've just warehoused them. And we haven't done anything yet, and I'm not sure why, to help children and to help families, because that's where it starts. And if you provide support for families and provide support for children, you aren't going to have them end up in prison.
Right. Our prison population, we've done a few interviews here about that, too, is just exploding.
Mm-hmm.
And the recidivism rate is, 70-75%? It's insane. So it's a very broken system. And yet, like you say, you know, the rehabilitation efforts have thinned out. People like that soundbite, you know, in from politicians about tough on crime, but it doesn't work like that. If you really want to be tough on crime, work with them, you know, when they're broken families, because it's hurt people who hurt people.
That's when you can do some good. When I was in California, I also worked with homeless children in Richmond. Richmond is the poorest part of the Bay Area. And I worked really hard with those kids because I could help them more and faster. I also worked hard with my jail students. I worked in the San Francisco jail as well. They had a wonderful program there.
Yeah.
Those men had drama classes, they had writing classes, they had computer classes. And there was a program, I wasn't too involved with this, but there was a program where if they got out, they could get jobs moving furniture. A lot of these guys were really strong. They worked out all the time.
Yeah.
So there was hope. Often in the prisons, there was not hope.
And writing, you've talked about that elsewhere, too. And that could pertain to you as well as with some of the people that you've worked with. But you've talked about that it begins with a wound that you need to heal. Did you find that true for yourself as you wrote your memoirs, or perhaps when you worked with broken people, did it actually have a healing effect?
We're all broken and we're all healing. I mean, we're all falling apart and all coming together all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, I have a meltdown every few days. I'm sure everybody does. And then you regroup and you go on. I think in my case, very early in my life, because I was raised as a boy for the first 10 years, and then that didn't really take, I had to...
You're going to have to explain that.
I had to figure out myself in relationship to my world and give it a lot of thought. My parents had three sons who died at birth. One was a late-term miscarriage, and the other one lived 6 weeks, and one died when he was born. They all had congenital defects. They were all boys. And I was the surrogate son.
Mm.
It was at a time that people did that more often. It wasn't completely unheard of, I learned later. And there are cultures, too, where they do that. In Afghanistan, in Albania, they will, if there are no boys, they will designate a girl to be a boy.
Meaning what? You dressed as a boy?
They blurred the edges. I wore jeans. I never wore dresses. I went with my father to his lumber mill and kept him company and was trained by him, supposedly to follow in his footsteps. And he tried to teach me how to hunt. He tried to teach me how to fish, which I was really bad at. And he did teach me how to ride horses and how to take care of them, which I was much better at. But still, I think it's the analogy would be to someone who's gay, that when puberty hits, all of a sudden, light breaks on Marblehead, and you think, wait a minute. Wait a minute.
Not quite a son.
Not quite a son. And the transition took me for a while, too. It didn't happen right away that I realized that I was not going to be my father's partner.
As
a male, as a surrogate male. So I had to figure that out. My parents' marriage ended. I had to figure that out. And so my grandmother died. I was really close to her. I had to figure that out. Sometimes people just wall stuff off and go on.
Mm-hmm.
What did Bill Clinton say? I put that in a box and I don't think about it. Well, I wasn't that type.
Yeah.
I was the
compartmentalization.
Right.
Yeah.
I didn't do that. So I figured things out. I think that was my beginning as a writer. So then I could help people do the same thing. I could help them weigh and look at and not be afraid of, whether it was little children or whether it was great big criminals. You know, didn't matter to me.
Yeah.
I've worked with all kinds. And when I worked with the children in a homeless shelter, well, it was children from the homeless shelter in Richmond, I had two little girls who did not talk. They were from some place like Guatemala or El Salvador. And I couldn't engage them. They didn't cause trouble,
but
they didn't engage. And I spoke a little Spanish, so it wasn't even just the language barrier. So I went to the director of the program, and she said that neighbors had reported them screaming, and they had called protective services, but it turns out, you know, the little girls were having nightmares. It wasn't that they were being hurt in their apartment. They had watched their father tortured to death in front of them. Yeah, think about that. So I just kept kind of pretending that they were normal. That's what you do anyways. Yeah. You just pretend everything's normal. Well, one day I brought in poems in Spanish about stars, and also I brought in photos and paintings. I remember it was Van Gogh's O Starry Night.
Mm.
And whatever they did, I praised them. Everybody. That's my trick as a teacher.
And I imagine these are people who have probably gotten very little praise in their lives.
I never criticize. I always praise.
Yeah.
So we drew stars for quite a long time. Then we had a little snack break. And when we came back and started writing, I noticed that the older sister, and she had a plate in her face. I never knew why. I didn't know if she'd been injured or what. But anyway, she's writing and writing and writing. And I just ignore it. I just pretend, okay, that's and I'm working with many students, right?
Right, right.
So when the class is over, I put everything away. I collect it just like normal. And as soon as the kids are gone, I get out her work. And she said in her Spanish, I could understand it, when I'm very alone and afraid, I imagine that there's a star in the sky that used to be inside of me, and then it was not anymore. And one night, I was looking out at the sky, and the star came down and entered into me, and it was as if it had always been there. And then it went back in the sky, and the clouds came, but I could feel it there, and I fell asleep, and I was happy. And I thought, oh, my God. And I took it to one of my neighbors who was bilingual, and they said she had a breakthrough. I didn't even know I didn't think she could write. I didn't even know if she could talk. But then after that, the little girls talked and laughed and were normal children.
What an incredible story, Kathleen. You're bringing tears to my eyes here.
I think when I think about it, they came back.
Yeah.
And her metaphor for it, and I think she experienced this. I think she literally felt that the star came into her and then went back to the sky. It was her spirit. And I believe we all have a spirit inside of us. And everywhere I've been, I have felt keenly the connections with other people. We are no different. And so when I read about these children coming from Latin American countries to our border and being sent back in many cases to die, I feel that and want to do something about it. It's like the people who saw the children going to Auschwitz. And I know from my niece, who is part Dutch and now lives in Amsterdam, she said her grandmother used to ride her bike out into the country and get as many kids as she could off the trains and put them with farm families.
Oh.
So I feel now with all these immigrants coming, and especially the children, that
all these refugee stories we see,
we can't say that's somewhere else. We are all connected, and we are responsible for all humanity. And I think that when I traveled, I needed to experience that. I needed to experience it and know it deeply.
Yeah.
Not just from reading. Not just from reading.
You've come home with a lot of wisdom, Kathleen. And all the travels that you've done, all the experiences that you've had out in the world, how did that change, assuming it did, your view of home?
Well, they say when you travel, the place you learn most about is where you're from.
Yeah.
I think that it allowed me not to feel a difference anymore. Right now, I'm working on an essay about a young man who has an orchard on the Lillooet Peninsula and his girlfriend who's working with orphans in Haiti. And I see that young people, especially, she's 25, he's 30, are no longer happy to be unconnected from the rest of the world. And somehow those things are combined and connected. And it makes perfect sense to me that he's going to go there in a couple months. She's going to come back to the Lillooet Peninsula. How they will combine avocation and vocation, orphans and orchards, I don't know. But I see that that is the coming paradigm. And I think that I'm feeling it. Other people are feeling it. And I'll tell you, there's no place that could be more different from Haiti than the Lillooet Peninsula.
Yeah.
But it's not enough anymore to seal ourselves off. We are all connected.
Yeah. You know, we started this conversation talking about the internet, and we are so connected now digitally, electronically, which at the same time I think has made us more disconnected, losing touch with our own communities, not even knowing who our neighbors are. And maybe especially the younger generations are coming up feeling something's missing.
Well, I think the Lillooet Peninsula people do know their neighbors, and they're all connected. I think what they want to do, like I did, is feel that for everywhere.
Yeah.
So they aren't... They aren't separate. Probably the thing that has changed in me is that I have more faith. It's not exactly religious. Einstein said something deeply mysterious is behind all of this.
Yeah.
And I think it's a faith in the goodness of people and in something good in the universe. And I feel it almost as if it's, like an electric pulse or a twinge or I feel it almost physically, so that I feel happier probably than I did when I left, because I'm more sure that there is goodness. I see and saw a lot of very hard things.
Yeah.
But it didn't make me feel hopeless or cynical, but just the reverse. I don't know how I can explain it, but
a more pronounced darkness perhaps makes the light that much brighter beside it?
Something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I am just sure I have encountered incredible goodness in people everywhere I went, random. And I believe that it's there.